Joining us today on the Innovative Ideas podcast is Dr. Paul A. Offit. Dr. Offit is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit is also the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He is a recipient of many awards, including the J. Edmund Bradley Prize for Excellence in Pediatrics, bestowed by the University of Maryland Medical School, the Young Investigator Award in Vaccine Development from the Infectious Disease Society of America, and a Research Career Development Award from the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Offit, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've had a few years now to try and bring our vaccine capacity up to where I think a lot of experts and public officials think it needs to be, starting, I think, after 2001 and the anthrax attacks, and then the emergence of avian flu in the middle of this decade, H5N1, really raised the possibility that we could be dealing with unknown pathogens, or natural or man-made, and that our vaccine capacity was not really where it was or needed to be. Under President Bush, there were a number of vaccine expansion programs, billions of dollars devoted to expanding pandemic preparedness and improving the U.S.'s capacity for making advanced vaccines with new cell vaccine technologies. And yet this year, struggling to grapple with the latest pandemic version of the flu, that's the swine flu, the H1N1, we've already had shortages of both the seasonal flu vaccine and the N1 vaccine. Why are we still playing catch-up today? Is this just a natural learning curve, or are there things that we should be doing better?
Well, I think it's definitely a learning curve. As you correctly point out, I think with the emergence of the H5N1 virus, the avian flu virus, and the fear that that virus, you know, was distinct and could be a pandemic strain, the Bush administration, in conjunction with people like Tony Fauci at NIAID, you know, really, I think, put in place an infrastructure to make a lot of vaccine quickly. I mean, because you don't have that much time between when you realize that a pandemic is here. I mean, the novel H1N1 virus didn't appear in the United States until April, until when you to make a vaccine. It's hard to do that. It's hard to make a lot of vaccine quickly. And I think we did a pretty good job. I mean, I think we made a lot of vaccine pretty quickly. The problem was is that at least for the first wave of novel H1N1, we had difficulties distributing a lot of that vaccine and getting it to the people who needed it. And I think that's been a learning curve. I think we will get better at that. And I think there will be, on all likelihood, you know, at least a second wave of novel H1N1, and then even maybe one later in February or March. So I think those who've gotten the vaccine will benefit from it. The seasonal flu vaccine has always been difficult. I mean, it is arguably the only generic vaccine. A number of companies make it. There's not a great infrastructure for making a lot of seasonal flu vaccine. And frankly, you know, at the end of every year, often these companies are incinerating a lot of doses. So I think we're sort of shoehorning, as we've now made essentially a routine recommendation for all children between 6 months and 18 years of age to get the flu vaccine. I think we'll get better and better at it. It was hard to get, you know, two flu vaccines into so many people this year. It's just a hard thing to do.
And they also were having problems, as I understand it, with growing the H1N1, the swine flu vaccine, in eggs. It wasn't growing quite as well as they would have liked.
Right, and that's occasionally an unpleasant surprise, where you find that at least the seed virus doesn't grow particularly well in the so-called chorioallantoic cells of hen's eggs. You know, hopefully we'll be able to, there's no reason we can't adapt this virus to growth in mammalian cells and have at least a more consistent substrate. It's hard to, you know, get, you know, millions of eggs every year to grow your vaccine. It'd be nice to use the same technology, frankly, to choose to make the measles and mumps and rubella and polio vaccines, which is just mammalian cells.
If I recall correctly, until relatively recently, there was only one vaccine manufacturer with plants in the flu vaccine manufacturer with a plant in the U.S. So the U.S. was a little bit behind the curve, and a lot of countries can't make domestically enough of their own vaccine production. They have to buy it from abroad, so we have to buy it from abroad. How close are we to expanding domestic vaccine capacity, if you have any sense of that? And how close are those tissue or cell line vaccine production facilities to coming online?
I think mammalian cell line production facilities are not that far away. I think encouraging American pharmaceutical companies to make vaccines is much more difficult. Vaccines are not a huge moneymaker. They're not something that one takes every day. They're something that a medical product that one takes a few times or at most in one's lifetime, and that's it. So they're never going to be blockbusters. I mean, you know, Lipitor arguably is a single cholesterol-lowering agent, has a larger market than, you know, arguably the entire worldwide vaccine market combined. So that's always going to be a problem. And you know, American vaccine makers suffered in the 1980s from what was a flood of litigation. It drove a lot of them out of the market. I mean, ultimately, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act stabilized the market, made it more difficult to sue pharmaceutical companies for frivolously for you know, for vaccine related complaints. But it did. But a lot of them never came back.
One other fact that, or technological tweak, I should say, that can help pharmaceutical manufacturers expand access to the vaccine is the use of adjuvants. And I think we've talked about this before. I understand GlaxoSmithKline did a test, I think earlier this fall, where they had one dose of an adjuvant vaccine that only required 5.25 micrograms of antigen. That's the material that stimulates the immune system. Without it, they needed almost triple the dose, 15 micrograms. The CDC and the FDA opted to go without adjuvants, which, with all the other things that are going on that you just talked about, the virus doesn't grow terribly well in existing chicken egg technologies. We haven't perhaps been able to stretch our vaccine supply as far as we might have if we had used adjuvants, which are apparently used in vaccines in Canada and Europe. Can you comment? Do you think that was a mistake, or do you think that was a right call given these overblown, admittedly, you know, somewhat ridiculous fears about vaccines in the U.S.?
I think it was a tremendous lost opportunity. You know, you're right in that adjuvants like squalene have been used and are being used to enhance the immune response of influenza vaccine, both in Europe and Canada. What an adjuvant does is it allows one to use a far lesser quantity of vaccine virus or to give fewer doses. And, you know, when you're trying to get a lot of vaccine out quickly, this is frankly the perfect way to get the most out of the vaccine virus that you have. But I think what the tail wagged the dog here. I think that health officials were breathed a sigh of relief when they realized that you could at least get an adequate immune response, you know, with you know, a standard amount of antigen, and that they didn't have to go to an adjuvant. But certainly adjuvants like squalene have been used safely for years. Squalene is a natural product. It's part of cholesterol synthesis. It's in many foods that have light oils in them, Girl Scout cookies being one example. You know, we're exposed to squalene all the time, but certainly the anti-vaccine forces are very good, have been very good about getting the message out there that squalene is dangerous. It's been, you know, blamed for as a cause of Gulf War syndrome. And I think the public health community didn't want to have to face up to trying to, frankly, educate the public about this, the fact that squalene is perfectly safe. It will enable us, would have enabled us to, I think, get out a lot more vaccine quickly. I think it was a real lost opportunity. I think we made a mistake here.
And, you know, that was a decision perhaps made by the CDC and the FDA when they thought they'd have a lot more vaccine than it turned out that they did. Are we going to get beyond that discussion about adjuvants? You know, you just talked very articulately for a moment about the vaccine fear-mongering industry in the U.S., driven primarily by the trial bar. You've written a couple of wonderful books about it, The Cutter Incident and then Autism's False Prophets. When are we going to get beyond this discussion, or at least get to the point where science is dictating, you know, vaccine policy and not, you know, at the margins, you know, people who are reacting more from fear than from reason?
I think we're actually getting better in a few ways. If you look, for example, at the vaccine autism debate, that was a debate that was entertained by mainstream media, LA Times, New York Times. That has largely gone away. I mean, I think that the notion that vaccines, you know, might cause autism, something that's clearly been disproven by the scientific study, has now become the province of, you know, blogs, anti-vaccine blogs, and entertainment television, local news. I mean, those things are going to be always very hard to change. But I think that the mainstream media really has turned, and I think as a consequence, public opinion has turned on that. And so I'm very encouraged by that. Plus, I think that what you're seeing, you're certainly starting to see the effects of at least pockets of children that are unvaccinated or undervaccinated, and as a consequence, we've had things like a measles epidemic in 2008 that was larger than anything we've seen in more than a decade. We've had you know pertussis or whooping cough pockets of epidemics that have frankly have the epidemiological patterns of things that we saw in the pre-vaccine era, meaning, you know, children between 5 and 9 year olds are affected, which is very odd. And we've had, you know, children now die from bacterial meningitis from a type of bacteria that's been, for which there's been a vaccine for more than a decade. But now you're starting to hear, I think where the change is coming, I think this will be the discussion over the next decade, you're for the first time starting to hear the voice of what I would call society. You know, typically you only hear the voice of the individual. You know, I believe my child was hurt by a vaccine, even when science doesn't show that. Now you're starting to hear, for example, parents who will write articles on Slate.com or who have been on NPR who would say, you know, my child was too young to get vaccinated and yet was exposed to somebody who chose not to get vaccines, who caused not only their child but my child to get sick. You know, or my child can't be vaccinated because they're getting chemotherapy for their cancer, or immunosuppressive therapy for their transplants. So you're making a choice for my child. My child depends on a population to be immune. And you're seeing hospitals actually start to now mandate flu vaccine, which is to say they consider it not your social responsibility, but your professional responsibility to be vaccinated. That, to me, is the voice of society. And I think you're going to start to hear that more and more. It's actually been quite encouraging.
So you're actually a little bit optimistic about the future of vaccine technology and vaccine acceptance generally.
I'm definitely optimistic about vaccine technology. I think we're at a point really where we really have the technology that will enable us to prevent the diseases that kill us. And I'm talking about diseases worldwide like malaria, tuberculosis, HIV. I'm very optimistic about that. What I'm little less optimistic about is the irony of the fact that despite we have that technology in hand, we, I think, in many ways don't understand it or frightened by it. And historically, that's always been true. I think as you develop, you become more scientifically sophisticated, there often is a backlash in a society that to some extent doesn't understand that technology, a backlash against it. And I think, I mean, it's sort of, you know, the invention of electricity and Frankenstein, right? The fear that, you know, that you can reanimate people with electricity, something that's actually not true.
Well, that's certainly a very good point. We'll end our discussion on that, which is eventually, hopefully, evidence wins out the day and we get a better public policy as a result of it. Dr. Offit, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure.